You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Children International is working to end child poverty around the world by giving kids access to a safe place, a team, and a path out of poverty by focusing on health, education, empowerment, and employment. Together, with people like you, we're more than a nonprofit. We're a powerful force for change. Learn more at children.org.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, November 7th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor, Princeton University, and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium, Sam Wong, will be joining us. Also on the... He'll give us percentages and et cetera, et cetera. Also on the program today, Donald Trump in the bunker of his mind. Latino voting surges. Suppression working in North Carolina? Now it's a question mark. James Comey, you remember him, the FBI chief? Remember that big investigation? Blow the lid off this thing? Yeah, he said never mind yesterday.
Should have added, and I resign.
He may well do. Also, breaking, no one tried to assassinate Donald Trump with a gun or even a mean sign. Heritage Foundation calls for a Supreme Court nominee blockade, which means we are days away from the Republican Party adopting it as an article of faith. And Chris Christie says Bridgegate plot was stupid. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, we are, nearly one-third of the voters have already voted in this election. I am one of those. That's right. I'm not going to be up in 19th district. I already voted. But tomorrow is when we will find out. I would say there's a high probability that tomorrow is the day that we will find out who will be the president by the end of the day. Now, it's not like there isn't a precedent for these things to be contested. But let me make something clear. You don't need a candidate to concede for there to be a winner of the election. Some people sometimes, like, what if he doesn't concede? What if Donald Trump does not concede? And I'll tell you what will happen if Donald Trump does not concede. We will be denied the pleasure of watching that speech and watching the crestfallen faces of Trump supporters. But beyond that, that's it. And he'll be mocked. And then it'll give the opportunity for Republicans who have all enabled Donald Trump to finally say, you know what? I think this guy's bad. Look at this. He's not even conceding. I am taking away my support from him. I can't look in the face of my daughter and say that I support this guy after he will now not concede. This is embarrassing. He's a bad person. A total bad hombre. And then 25% of those Republicans who will say it will then announce the launch of their campaign committee for the 2020 nomination. I mean, that's the way I think this is going to go down.
And I just want to say, they aren't all rapists, but they still should be shocked with cattle prods and kicked out of the country. In their, in terms of their immigration policies and their follow-up from Donald Trump.
Well, if you have to explain it.
It wasn't really a joke.
Well, that's true. Okay, but anyway.
Jesus. Wow.
Well, you just jumped in there, and I thought you had something, and then I feel like you got a little lost.
It happens to the best of us.
Believe me, I'm there 90% of the time.
I know.
Folks, speaking of lost, you know, without data, you're completely lost. Periscope data is the ultimate tool for fast and flexible data visualization. Why run slow queries on old spreadsheet data when Periscope data allows you to run, visualize, and share analyses over billions of data rows in seconds? Answer the big questions instead of running routine SQL tasks again and again. Periscope data is fast, powerful, and effortless to connect. You get three kinds of fast. You get the blazing fast query execution, you get the fast workflow, and you get the fast sharing. Plus, ease of trial. There's no setup cost, no time. Traditional BI tools take over a month to get your ETL configured. With Periscope, you can get trialing and delivering insights as soon as you plug in your credentials. And it's easily reversible. It takes one click to disconnect if you decide you don't want to move forward. So this is something that if you are one of those people working at your small business or your big business where you've got to analyze the data and then you've got to figure out how to share it and then Bill over in, I don't know, R&D says, hey, what if we did this and that? You're going to go back in and redo the whole thing. You're going to want to try this out. Periscope data is a powerful and intuitive tool that will bring your SQL analysis to the next level. Get a free trial today by going to www.periscopedata.com/majority. That's periscopedata.com/majority. I'm going to assume that if you are running query execution on your data set, that you know that online, I don't have to say the www part, right? I mean, is that a fair assessment?
It could be a fair assessment.
I couldn't find periscopedata.com/majority because you didn't mention the www. I didn't realize it was on the World Wide Web. Check it out today, periscopedata.com/majority. All right, should we, what was that? What is going on? Matt seems to be having like some type of nervous breakdown.
He's a little rattled about the election.
There's a lot of like people are very uptight about the election.
Matt and I are just having a nervous breakdown over here.
Okay, sorry. Why? What's going on?
No, we're not.
I feel like my cortisol levels have gone up. Just watching what's going on over there. It's like running around like chickens with the heads cut off.
We're sitting down.
Well, I mean, for chickens sitting down. All right, folks, before we get to Sam Wong, I recorded him earlier this morning. Nothing's changed since then, I should tell you. I think it's time for our predictions. Are you guys ready?
No.
What do you mean you're not ready? What are you waiting for? Like another... One more shoe to drop on the...
I was waiting for the pre-record so I can do some last-minute research.
That's the whole point, is you don't want to just have your predictions clouded by the Wong
Well,
interview.
He doesn't give... okay. I don't think he didn't. I don't think I asked for percentages from him. I didn't...
All right.
I don't think he does that.
No. He's a little more sophisticated than that.
Well, no. I mean, it's not so much that he's sophisticated
he's
or not sophisticated.
He's a little less sophisticated than that.
He just basically aggregates the polls as they go along. And then just anticipates the likelihood of the outcomes, not necessarily what the spread's going to be.
Well, I'm ready. I've done the same thing, but also integrated some astrology into mine.
All right. Well, let's hear Michael and I.
No. Okay, we're going to go. Okay, go ahead, Sam.
Okay, let me, I have my notes. Here, okay. I'm struggling with this because in my heart says the Democrats, Clinton's going to win Ohio. But my head says no, they're not. Because Portman is going to drive people out despite the fact that Casey, but I think it's going to be super close. So my guess, and I've been saying for a while, I think it's going to be bigger than 2012 and smaller than 2008, or just pushing up against the 2008 margin. Okay, so you'll recall in 2008, the percentage that Obama beat John McCain, and you'll recall also, I won $200 from Ari Berman,
which you never got.
Which I never got.
Ooh.
I bet him in February of 2003 that Obama would beat McCain. Understand, in February, supposedly the primary wasn't resolved, but it more or less is at that time.
So, oh, you mean in February 2007?
2007, yeah.
Okay. So I was going to say, if you predicted in 2003, then you truly are unparalleled in the game.
I just had a sense about this guy. it was 53 to 40, let's call it 46%, essentially. So that was a 7-point spread, maybe 7.5. The popular vote, and the popular vote, it was like 69.5 million versus 60 million. The electoral spread was 365 to 173. In 2012, the electoral spread was 332 to 206, which I didn't realize. I didn't realize it was that tight. And the popular vote was 51 million versus 47 million, more or less. 51% versus 47%, 65 million to 61 million. So here's my prediction. I'm going to say that Clinton does not win Ohio. Not going to win Iowa, so relative to 2012, but she is going to win Arizona and North Carolina. And so I'm going to say 334 to 204 for Trump. I think, I mean, Ohio will make the big difference, and that will be, but that's, and I'm going to say in terms of the popular vote, I think it's going to be about, I think she's going to get about 50, just under 51%, but I don't think Trump is going to get above 44%. So I think the rest is going to be a mixture of like Evan McMullen and Gary Johnson, and maybe she gets 51%. So I think that there's going to be about a 6% spread, maybe close to 7%, just under. And then I'm going to say the Democrats hold the Senate. They'll take Nevada. They'll take Illinois, obviously, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and I'm going for it with New Hampshire.
Okay. Yeah, I think she's going to win Arizona. I think that there's going to be a real surge there. I think she's going to win North Carolina. I mean, I'll just make the heart pick with Ohio. I think it's 50-50, but I do think that I'm persuaded somewhat by ground game, and I also think that there's a fair amount of Portman voters in Ohio specifically that those could be some real ballot splitters. I think that that's an actual possibility. So she takes Ohio in my map, and he wins Iowa, which I think is clear. But my map, that takes her up to 352.
That's right.
So I think that
334 plus 18 yeah. would be 352.
Thank you for that astute interjection,
well,
Sam.
Well, anytime I can do math and yeah. impress people, I'm going to do it.
I don't know. I think in the context of this show, math is not really appreciated or warranted. But anyways, no, I put her at 352. I think that we were talking about this the other day, and her popular margin might just be helped by how big of a blowout California will be in and of itself.
That's right.
So I think that she'll get to a solid – it's not – different from you particularly, but I think it will be a solid 51. I think though Trump might be above 44. I don't know how many people are really going to stick with third parties at the end. Other than actually, he will win Utah, but Evan McMullen, I bet, will hang on to a significant portion of his vote there, and that will cut into his margin.
So wait, so what are you saying? So she's at 51%.
I think 45, 46.
45 or 46. Well, why don't you just say 47 too, so you can choose three numbers.
46.
46.
That would be my final number. Trump is at 46 in the popular vote.
Okay. That was interesting.
Democrats take the Senate. I think that they'll win all of the races that you mentioned, although I'm more wishy-washy. No, I'm really concerned about Wisconsin. I think Feingold is going to win, but I'm very concerned about that one. But I still think he'll pull that one out. Yeah, and they'll pick up 15 seats in the House.
Yes. Okay. Do you guys want to go or do you want to wait until after? Kelly?
Romp, romp, romp.
If you hadn't made me stay up all night making your predictions analysis, then I would have my own.
I told Kelly to do a regression analysis. Actually, I had to ask Sam Wong what that was in this interview coming up.
I actually know what that is.
For a long time, I have no doubt, for a long time, people have been asking us to get a certain Sam, who is a neuroscientist, on this program. And I am happy to say that we're going to take a quick break. And Sam Wong, neuroscientist from Princeton University and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium, will be joining us right after this quick break. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Sam Wong. He is a professor from Princeton University, a neuroscientist, one of the co-founders, I guess, of the Princeton Election Consortium, and a co-host of Politics and Polls with my friend Julian Zelizer. Sam, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on today.
So we're a day before the election, obviously. Before we get into your model and what you've predicted, one of the big things in the sort of the weedier parts of this world, it has been a fight that's broken out a bit about Nate Silver's modeling. And I know you're not in the business of critiquing other people's stuff, but if you could just give us a sense of what is the critique that other people are making, because Nate Silver's model for this has been pretty different than relative to, let's say, yours and the Huffington Post aggregation and the Upshot in the New York Times. What can you tell us about how it's different?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, as you pointed out, that this year, the 538 forecast, at least in terms of the win probability for the presidential race, their calculation is an outlier and seemingly a pretty strong outlier compared with all those other forecasts. My own forecast is an outlier in the other direction, but it's less obviously so because pretty much everybody's in the 90% range or higher for Hillary Clinton. So here's my take on what the 538 model does. I don't follow what they do closely, so I think I'm only going to be able to speak generally. Hold on for a second.
That's probably for the best, because I think if we got too specific, I at the very least wouldn't understand it. I mean, I'm sitting with very sophisticated analysis of it, and I don't understand it. So
yeah, so the way I'd put it is those guys are, Nate Silver has his origins in fantasy baseball, and so that's a domain in which people really care about individual player stats. And the analogous thing to individual player stats in polling aggregation is grading individual pollsters, trying to get individual states correct. And there are just a lot of parameters that go into estimating what individual pollsters and individual states are going to be like. And inevitably, when you do statistical analysis to try to get those things right, you introduce a little bit of uncertainty into each step of analysis. And so what they do there is this pretty intensive analysis where they try to get the individual parts right, and then that collectively then gives an estimate. And what I think is going on, and I have to be careful here because, of course, it's always hard to drill into somebody else's model. What I think is going on is that they add a lot of uncertainty along the way, both of the types that I just said, grading pollsters, grading states. Also, they try to bring in national polls. And the reason for that is that they are, after all, a news organization, and they want to get some movement. If something happens in the news, they want to know within a day or two whether anything happened. And state polls are the most accurate in the long run, but a little bit slow to accumulate. And so it's a little bit unsatisfying to wait for state polls to come in, which is actually what I do at the Princeton Election Consortium, because I'm not a news I don't run a news organization. I'm just trying to get an answer that I think is accurate. Anyway, so the bottom line here is that the Huffington Post article by Ryan Grimm says that Nate Silver is biased in favor of Trump, but I think it's more accurate to say that the calculation is biased against whoever happens to be the front runner. And because Hillary Clinton's been the front runner all year, it looks like a bias against her.
Now, I want to put a pin in that, that final conclusion, and just go back and make sure I understand. So what Silver does is he says, this pollster, I have measured his accuracy or her accuracy or the outfit's accuracy over the past 10 cycles, and they get a grade of 7. Versus another one that has a grade of 4. And so I weight their polls. I give greater weight to their polls in my aggregate formula. And then he does the same. I'm just making sure I understand this. He does the same with states. So Nevada is typically the aggregate of polls are 4 percentage points off. So I'm weighting that and giving it an extra point or two as I aggregate this stuff.
I think that's probably about right. I think one thing we don't know is, at least I don't know, is whether they use past years of performance by these pollsters. That could be risky because pollsters, of course, can change their methods. And, you know, because pollsters are, you know, they're professionals who are trying to do their best job. And so it's inevitable that a pollster is going to adjust things from election to election. So I think there's some risk if they do indeed go over multiple cycles. I don't know the answer to that. Another risk is that if you have an outfit that only polled once, I mean, for example, Michigan State University put one poll into the field, and over a two-month period, they gathered responses, and they got Hillary Clinton up by 20%. And I think it's pretty likely that Hillary Clinton is not going to win Michigan by 20 percentage points tomorrow on Tuesday on the election.
I'm really bad at math, and I would agree.
Yeah. So there's a risk involved in trying to grade individual pollsters. Over at the Princeton site, what my code does is it just uses the median, which is a simple statistical trick for getting rid of outliers that downweights outliers. And so the math that I use is not easily led astray by crazy individual polls. And so that's a way of doing it that doesn't require grading pollsters.
So why does his necessarily favor or run against the front runner? Why would that be the case? I'm still not quite clear.
Well, imagine that let's say we could know the true probability of winning any particular state. Let's say that we could know with great confidence who is going to win Pennsylvania on election day or Virginia or North Carolina. If we know those things, then the probability is going to be something like, you know, 95 to 100%. And then we can definitively say who's going to win those states. Now, if we don't know, if we have an approach that introduces more uncertainty, then those states turn a little bit more into coin tosses, where it's more like, let's say it's, you know, 3-to-1 odds or 2-to-1 odds. And now what that means is that you have to account for either the possibility that one candidate wins, the favorite, or the other candidate. And what that means is the average result is no longer going to be all the electoral votes for candidate A, but it's going to be some kind of intermediate thing where the average result is going to be somewhere between all the electoral votes for candidate A and all the votes for candidate B. And so what that leads to is uncertainty. It also leads to something that's closer to the midpoint, right? So, for instance, if Pennsylvania were, you know, a perfect toss-up, then the average result would be 9 electoral votes for each candidate instead of 18 for one candidate.
I see. Okay. All right. So with that, all that said, Clinton's going to win.
It seems pretty likely. Yeah, I think it would be really surprising if she didn't win.
From what point on was it basically statistically And I think you're, I don't know what the model is up to date. Wait a second. It is at about a 90. Well, you have about a 99%, just under a 99% chance of winning. That's pretty, pretty good. if you're right. Yeah. And so at what point did it, let's say, break through the 90s? Was there ever a time it was less than that?
Yeah, during the summer, the way I calculate the possible uncertainty, it was hovering around in the 80% range back in July and August. That's a time when polls are less accurate and there can be more movement between polls and election day. I think be careful about the 99% thing. I've been thinking about that a bit. And I think that any probability that's greater than about 90 to 95% is really sensitive to the exact assumptions that get made about exactly how far off things can go. And so I don't necessarily view 99%, which is what election.princeton.edu is currently reporting. I don't view that as that different from, say, 95%. You know, it's obviously conceptually a significant difference. But it's just hard to estimate probabilities very well at that end. And I think that, you know, I think it's fair to say that the probability of a Clinton victory is at least 95%. As far as I can tell, that is well supported. And it happens that the assumptions that I made give 99%. You know, to be truthful, I didn't actually think when I set this up back in the summer, I didn't think there would be a lot of questions about this at this point. And it's ended up becoming a real bone of contention that's sort of erupted. There's been, you know, all this fuss that's erupted.
I got to be honest with you. For me, 95%, 99%, 90%. I mean, I don't even understand, to be honest with you, and this is going to sound, I mean, I know this is going to disappoint people in the audience that I don't even have this type of grasp on statistics. But really, I mean, does that mean, let's say it's 95, does that mean that if you were to run this election 100 times, she'd win 95 out of those times? I mean, what possibly could happen in those other five times?
Well, what could happen? I mean, so an example of what could happen would be pollsters just guessed wrong as a community about who was going to vote, and they just were unable to guess how many, I don't know, disgruntled whites were going to, whites without college educations, we're going to turn out for Donald Trump. Or maybe they didn't anticipate that turnout would be really off because some giant storm hitting the East Coast, where there are a lot of Democratic states, or things like that. And so, yeah, so I think the general idea is that it's something like if we ran 100 elections. Probably a more realistic way to think about it is something like there are, you know, 56 contests, 50 states, D.C., and a handful of congressional districts. And a more realistic way of thinking about it is that if we had 95% probabilities for all of those 56 races, then realistically, if the probability is calculated correctly, then say two or three of those would turn out to be wrong calls. Like, you know, maybe we'd get, maybe the Princeton Election Consortium would get, oh, I don't know, maybe we'd get Iowa wrong or New Hampshire wrong or the second district of Maine wrong, things like that.
So it's essentially like what we're really measuring is the skill set really of the pollsters, right? Like, you know, sometimes they get things wrong. Their assumptions may be wrong about who's going to vote, who's not going to vote. So and there's a couple of things that are left out of that. And one which I wanted to ask you is like, how do you deal? And now you're not a pollster, so this is really not even in your purview, I guess. But because of the nature of your model, I guess you wouldn't even contemplate this in terms of developing this number. But is there anybody out there who is attempting to quantify the difference between having a what is probably one of the most sophisticated, advanced get out the vote processes we've probably ever had in history versus one that doesn't even seem to be trying? I mean, this isn't even like, this is like measuring, it's not even measuring like Honeycrisp versus a delicious apple. This is just like, you can't even measure, this is like going to like measuring an apple versus a banana.
Yeah, or the orange flavor of a tasty tire rim.
Right, I mean, it's...
So yeah, I think that's a great question. I will say that one should be careful about getting too exuberant about the power of get out the vote activities. I remember when I first started doing this in 2004, which was 4 years before it became really a nationwide activity to watch polls so closely. In 2004, I was under the impression that undecided voters would break against the incumbent president, George W. Bush, and that there would be some hidden bonus for Senator John Kerry. And that did not materialize. And so so I took a bath on that one. And so I think one should be careful about that. Now, on the other hand, you are correct that it is a highly unusual situation for one side to be so sophisticated. I've been told that the Clinton campaign has something like 50 statisticians and headed by a faculty-grade person basically running analyses to allocate resources and send the candidate around and buy ads and so on. And that's a pretty giant operation in optimization. And so in some sense, I think that Donald Trump is making a contribution to political science research and social science research by doing kind of this big experiment in seeing what happens when one side goes into the challenges of a modern campaign, you know, kind of unarmed.
Right. And this is like the baseline. You could almost not recreate this in a lab.
Yeah. I mean, yes. Now, the other side of it is that he's also a highly unusual candidate, and there's ways in which he moves people emotionally on both sides that that are the culmination of 20 years of trends. And so it's going to be hard to really tease apart exactly what the causes are of whatever we're going to see after Election Day. But he's an unusual animal, and we're about to get a whole ton of data about what happened after Tuesday.
Yeah, I think this is going to be amazing. I mean, because I also think that fundamentally the difference between 2004 and the 2016 in terms of just how narrowly each voter can be targeted, yeah. I think, and then of course executing what is possible is another question, but the resources available in terms of targeting voters, I mean, the amount of data that now exists that didn't exist in 2004, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, because you don't have the same type of Google data, and literally, I mean, their data that I think it's legitimate to suspect that the Clinton campaign has access to an inordinate amount of that. Et cetera, et cetera. It seems to be so far beyond where we were. And then, of course, like you say, I mean, Trump doesn't seem to be interested in any of it. I mean, there's a report that he fired his pollster like a week ago because he didn't want to pay him. I mean, so who knows?
Because he can get it for free on websites.
Yeah, exactly.
So
right.
So one example of that is that earlier this season during the primaries, one of my readers at election.princeton.edu, who goes by the pseudonym N, found out that one could use Google search terms that were completely unrelated to the primaries, completely unrelated to politics. And she found that it was possible to predict with some precision vote shares of both the Republican candidates in the Republican primaries, state by state, and also the Democratic candidates in the primaries, state by state. And it was a remarkable feat of big data analytics and basically doing a massive regression, and that's using publicly available data that Google Correlate makes available, and that information is available on a more granular level. One could conceivably go town by town, street by street, congressional district by congressional district, and find out, well, this is a community where maybe we should work a little harder. And so there's layers upon layers of information for narrow casting likely supporters. And just, getting them with relatively strong accuracy, which isn't necessarily good for democracy because it reduces conversation for across groups. But it certainly is an interesting exercise in optimization.
Yeah, I share your concern about making this everything too data driven. It's the nature of the era. And with that said, let me ask you this one question, too, before we move on to the Senate, so that I can fully embarrass myself. explain to people, when you talk about regression data analysis, what does that mean?
Well, generally speaking, so Princeton Election Consortium doesn't do that much regression, but generally speaking, the idea would be, in the case of Google Correlate, people can do this. It's actually kind of a cool tool. If you search my website, you can find this analysis. What you do is you get a collection of polling data for states that have opinion polls, say, Virginia, North Carolina, what have you, like 20 states or so, and you pour them into Google Correlate. You just like upload a file. And Google Correlate looks through all its data and says, the patterns of web searches for a particular search term that look the most like the pattern that you gave me would be, this search term. So, for instance, the pattern that most closely matches John Kasich's support during the primaries was the web search term net cost, which is like this kind of dreary economic, financially kind of thing. And, you know, kind of makes you think of John Kasich. And so that's a search term that, in fact, does a pretty good job of matching state-to-state patterns for Kasich. Now, it's not clear what the cause is, but if you have enough of those, then it's possible to say, okay, well, we've got a bunch of these things that kind of match Kasich support. Other things include like mortgage amortization, other kind of econ-y kind of things, Joseph Stiglitz. Those terms match, and then it's possible to take those and say, okay, well, if they match, then I can use those to, I can average them in a way and estimate about how much support there is for Kasich in places where we don't know, where we don't have any polling data. And so regressions are good for basically, they're good for a lot of things. They're a universal tool in social sciences and physical sciences like neuroscience, which is my field. But one thing they're good for is filling in places where we don't have a direct measurement. We have to guess. Like if I want to know, I know the temperature in Princeton today, I can look up the temperature in Philadelphia today. You know, maybe I don't know what the temperature is in Yardley, which is halfway between. And I could, find some way of figuring that out from other data. So that's sort of what regressions are for.
All I can think about is that Google Correlate is that there has to be a way for us to raise the shareability of our YouTube videos.
That is almost certainly true. You can probably do great analytics to get whatever goal. You know, it's one of the ways Google makes money, right? By using its massive amount of data to do things like target products.
All right, so let's move on to the Senate, and sure. I want to also just touch on your before we get to the Senate. You have a feature on your site, or I should say on the site, on the Princeton Election Consortium, the power of your vote. What is that? Explain that to me.
Yeah, this is a tool for activists, and so the idea here is that if a race is really lopsided and you know that somebody's going to win by 10 or 20 points, then your individual effort is not going to make much difference either in that race or in the case of the national question, the presidency, or control of the Senate. So that would be a state like, say, Alaska, where Lisa Murkowski is winning by like 30 or 40 points. Now, an example of a state where an individual person's effort might make more difference is Missouri, where Kander and Blunt are in a Senate race where they're within 1 point of each other. And furthermore, an example where getting one person out to vote could make a huge difference is New Hampshire, where Kelly Ayotte and Maggie Hassan are within half a percentage point, at least in my poll median. And so the power of one vote, which is on the right sidebar of the site, basically shows where getting out the vote can make the most difference. And it's very much a tool for activists.
That's fascinating because I know of a lot of people going to Nevada. I know a lot of people going to Nevada, I should say,
going
to Pennsylvania. But I have not heard of anybody going to New Hampshire. And that is really surprising. So, I mean, folks, if you're listening, there's still time. Head up to New Hampshire. I mean, we have
The hot spots are New Hampshire, Missouri, Indiana, Wisconsin, and North Carolina. Those are major hot spots for getting out the vote
for
the Senate.
So let's. That's a great way to introduce the Senate. If the presidential race is all but over, and I have to say that it has been my completely non-statistical analysis that it was over sometime in April, when it was quite clear that Donald Trump was going to be the nominee, just because that was my opinion. But the Senate, however, it seems like it's really tough to know right now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is tough to know. Part of it is, in fact, that some of these states that are very close, polling is kind of sparse. Like in Indiana, there's a law against using an auto dialer machine to call people for polling. And so that means that phones have to be dialed, I guess, manually in order to reach people, which makes polling expensive. And so right now it looks like there's something like 48 seats that are likely to be Democratic or independent. And then there are five races that Democrats would need to win two of. assuming a Democratic vice president, Tim Kaine, they would need to win two of the five races that I listed in order to gain control of the Senate. And those five, think of them as coin tosses. So, you know, if you flip a coin five times, how do you feel about getting heads twice or more? You know, it seems like it would be a relatively good bet that you would get two or more, but you might not. And so that's where things are at. So, the Senate is on a knife edge.
So you say Wisconsin, North Carolina, New Hampshire, Indiana, and Missouri.
Correct.
Yep. So Nevada.
Well, yeah. Cortez, in Nevada, Maestro, Cortez Masto, yeah. She's up in polls by about 3 points. Nevada is a state that's been historically hard to poll, probably because so many people come and go from Nevada. It's a state that has that quality. And, for instance, Obama outperformed polls 4 years ago. Harry Reid very famously outperformed polls and defeated Sharon Angle 6 years ago. This seems to be a Nevada tradition. And I would say the fact that Cortez Masto is ahead by 3 points, plus that outperformance, plus, you know, the trickling in of information, like the fact that Latino turnout is so high, I think it's likely that the Democratic candidate is going to win that race. Seems like it would be a surprise if she lost.
And I'd feel the same way about Feingold, but it's tough. It's definitely getting tighter, it seems.
Yeah, that's a weird one. I actually wasn't expecting that one. I thought that he was a kind of a shoe-in, but that race narrowed dramatically in the last month or so. And so I think that one's going to be one that's probably worth watching on an election night.
Does anybody change their analysis based on early voting? I mean, because...
Good question.
You know, Sean Trend has a piece up that early voting is not predictive whatsoever, but I think his piece is a little bit thin, frankly, and I also think he's a partisan. I know he pretends he's not, but I do think he is. He's also...
Yeah, he looks for evidence. He's very sympathetic to evidence that favors what he would like to be true, and I think everyone's like that. I think that it's just really hard to avoid those biases, and I think that he's pretty good with data. But there's certainly, you know, there's no secret about what it is that he's interested in.
People, he's the guy who believes that there is a hidden white vote out there, that if it doesn't show up this time, I think we can safely say it's not there, right? I mean, ever. Yeah.
It's like the piece that came out in The Onion in the last few days, Donald Trump making one last bid to court white voters. Right. But anyway, I think that it is true that early voting is not proportional to final results, but it's not a bad thing to compare early voting this year to early voting 4 years ago. And early voting compared with 4 years ago is looking in some places stronger for Democrats, in places like Nevada, I think in North Carolina, in other places stronger for Republicans than 4 years ago, like Iowa. And that happens to match what we see in polling data. So I think it's not crazy to I think at a minimum, early voting is telling us that there doesn't seem to be a massive hidden amount of vote for either side. It feels like early voting approximately confirms what the opinion polling is telling us.
And aside from the big stories, it seems to me, in terms of the early voting, is that one, it is reflecting what more or less we're seeing in the polls. Two, that there seems to be a massive surge of Latino voting. And Latinos generally break for Democrats, it is 60-40 maybe, I think. But what we're seeing is an enormous amount of Latinos voting, because they tend not to be voting as much.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that that's more even to get even more granular there, that it's of Mexican descent tends not to vote as much. And from Central America, not to vote as much as, let's say, Puerto, Cubans, let's say.
So that's not a monolithic community, right? There's, as you point out, there's people from Cuba, there's people from, you know, Central America, there's people from Mexico. That's a population just across a number of those subgroups has not been so likely to vote. But there are obvious things happening in this campaign that really bring them in. Every time they get talked about, it's usually something like, you know, being on the wrong side of, you know, being put on the other side of a wall, or, you know, putting down Alicia Machado. Machado is a famous figure in that community.
Yes.
And so so I think that that's a community that has been woken up. And if there's a community that's been really rousted in ways that that hasn't happened before. Trendy might spend a little bit of time thinking about Latino votes.
Yeah, and it's also going to be interesting to see if this holds. I mean, insofar as this participation continues. I mean, generally we believe that it would, but it's hard to know. All right, so let me also ask you about this. What about voter suppression? Like, so in North Carolina, African-American voting, early voting, is down from 2012 numbers. And there are, I mean, the Department of Justice has specifically said, like, there's three counties with a vast majority of whom are populated by African-Americans, where the counties have engaged in caging and have taken people off the rolls. I guess conceivably they could get back on. But is there any way to measure something like that? Now, the Philly transit strike has been resolved, but had that been in there, does anybody have like a, I don't know, meteor hits the country type of scenario?
Yeah, it's hard to know what's going to happen there. These suppression efforts can have, you know, obviously are of great concern, obviously can have effects. In the case of early voting, it's hard to know because those people might, you know, people who have a harder time voting beforehand can still vote on election day. And I can't speak for anybody in those cage populations, but I can tell you that if I were held back from early voting because of some action meant to hold me back, I'd be pretty mad, and I would really make an effort to vote on election day. So so I think we don't know exactly what the net effect there is going to be. Probably is going to cut African-American turnout a bit, but I think we're going to find out afterwards. And these things, as you say, need to be addressed through legal means. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see significant legal action in North Carolina, because that's a close Senate race there, also close presidential race. And so that would be, you know, potentially ground zero for lawyering up.
All right. So lastly, and I want to ask you this without prejudicing people's, you should go and listen to the last version of Politics and Polls, where they talk about this in greater length. But what are the things that we should be looking for as results come in tomorrow? What things are going to be bellwethers that are going to give us a sense of how the night, and then I guess if we're going to wait for Trump to concede, the next 4 weeks to unfurl?
I would look in New Hampshire and North Carolina. Those states in closing polls are just about tied. And so depending on which way those states go, I think that would be a pretty early indication. Those are states that are likely to report relatively fast, and so I think that we're going to get a lot of information. North Carolina is must win at the level of the presidency, and so if Donald Trump does not win North Carolina, then it's game over for him. And if at a lower level, if the Senate candidates win in those states, winning either of those states would be a pretty strong indication that things might end up going okay for the Democrats for Senate control. So I'd watch the Senate races. As I said, 2 out of 5 states, of the ones I listed before, are needed. And the earliest ones we're going to learn about are New Hampshire and North Carolina. Florida's pretty close, too. That's another must-win state for Trump. And so, again, losing if Hillary Clinton wins in Florida, then that is, again, an indication of us asking, will Donald Trump concede?
Interesting. All right, well, there you have it. I think he could lose every state in the country, and I'm not even convinced he'd concede. The only chance is if he thinks he can actually do it during her speech, just to see if they would cut away from her. That's my pole position. Is like when he comes out, we'll be 5 minutes after she starts, after she's waited for him, and he won't do it. And the second one would be, I say, he does it in the morning, but in Trump Tower on something called Trump TV, and only give that out to the networks. Those are my two predictions.
Those seem like plausible speculations.
We'll see. Sam Wonk, thank you so much. Professor Princeton, the co-founder of Princeton Election Consortium. You can find that at election.princeton.edu. And the podcast is Politics and Polls. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we have a special. This is almost like a we got to do one of these jobbies. We have a special report from on the ground in North Carolina from a genuinely true patriot, American author, contributing editor to Harper's, New York Times Magazine, This American Life, maybe you've heard him on, and his one-man show. You haven't done that in a while. Ladies and gentlemen, Jack Hitt, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program, Jack.
Sam, great to be here. Great to report from the ditches of democracy out here.
Now, you are literally in the ditches of democracy. My understanding is your car broke down, and you're in North Carolina. Is that right?
I am. I am on Hawk's Nest Lane in beautiful Greenville, North Carolina, where my seven-year-old godson and I are helping to get out the vote. He saw Hamilton, wanted to participate in an election, so one thing led to another, and here we are.
Wow.
Clipboards in hand. We are going from door to door trying to drive people to the polls.
And so, So is the early voting still happening, or are you talking about tomorrow?
We're talking about only tomorrow. So early voting ended yesterday, or day before yesterday. And so now our task is to simply knock on the doors of people who have voted in the past and just say to their face, please vote. And that, apparently, that face-to-face contact has an enormous impact, according to all the studies. So we're here really, truly doing the donkey work of democracy. I mean, today our car broke down, the battery died, with some strange rental with some crazy battery thing. So, you know, we had to call in help and the whole, you know, it's just, this is the what it is. You know, people are not home. You know, they have to come back. It's, you know, wow. Yeah, democracy, very time-consuming.
Yes.
Very very time-consuming.
Well, so give us a sense of the neighborhoods, because the big story, at least in the early voting from North Carolina, seems to be that there was a surge of Latino voters, and that there was, and I've seen now contradicting reports of African-American early voting, that it surged in the last day or two. But with that said, it is still a decrease from 2012. Give me a sense of like the neighborhoods you're going to, and if you've picked up anything that would give you any insight into those reports.
Well, here is the weirdest thing I have to say. I don't feel any real enthusiasm on either side of the aisle here. I didn't expect it. I expected this to be this full-blown, you know, practical riot with lawn signs on every street corner. It's just not there. I mean, if anything, what you're finding is what I'm finding when I knock on these doors are people going, oh, yeah, okay, right, sure, you know, yeah, we're going to do that. And they seem like they're genuinely going to vote, but there does seem to be not the level of enthusiasm that you get in the sort of tight corridors of, like, you know, the MSNBC, the Fox News viewing audience.
Right.
All that said, though, the other thing that I have seen is that, you know, we hear so much about voter suppression and all these different ways in which you can kind of drive down the vote. And I've seen it firsthand now, and it's really simple. You just close the polling places. You know, many people don't have cars, or it's a big pain in the neck to get there, plus if they're lines. I talked to a man yesterday who's kind of ill, and I said, you know, you should get there early because there'll probably be lines, and I could just see it in his face. He wasn't going to go, you know, even though I arranged for him to get a ride. You know, it was just clear, like,
well,
he's not going to go.
Give me a sense of the type of the neighborhoods that you're in. Are you in, like, suburbs? Are they? Do you have a sense in terms of low, middle, high income demographics?
Yeah, right now I'm in a very middle class, middle-class neighborhood, the most manicured lawns you've ever seen. Absolutely perfect. You know, every house was probably built 10, 15 years ago. They're all very nicely kept. Everybody I've spoken to in this neighborhood is either Asian or Muslim or Black.
Hmm.
But this is a sort of a middle-class neighborhood. Yesterday, I was in a very poor, almost exclusively some white, but mostly African-American neighborhood that, you know, a lot of people didn't know where the polling place was, and it turns out it's fairly far away. So what I was going to say was, you know, if you just close down a polling place or you change its location, that is its own kind of suppression, because people think it's somewhere else, or they think it's at the church where it was last year or the last time they voted, or even in the primary. And these things have all changed. So for a lot of people, what we're doing is just informing them where the polling station is, and just arrange, or helping to arrange rides for many of the people who can't, who don't have cars, or, you know, there isn't a bus line out near to that polling station. So it's really like practical stuff like that, that actually, you know, seems to be more oppressive than any of the sort of like dramatic stuff that you hear Trump talking about, like dead people voting and names on rolls. It's much easier to just tamp down turnout than it is to try to generate fake voters.
Right. Now,
and
of course,
that's most easily done with just the basics of geography are the simplest way to suppress the vote.
Particularly if your bus that you're using to bus in all of those illegal voters,
right.
the battery
right.
dies, and then you're screwed.
One other sort of cheerful, upbeat note I want to add, which is that yesterday when we were talking to some of the locals, we were talking about the polling place of the area where we were going to be in, and the lady said, "Oh yeah, you know, it's that house, it's that building right next to the slushy place." She said, "Just tell everybody it's next to the slushy place. Everybody in town knows the slushy place." And sure enough, you know, when we'd get to people's houses, we'd give them the land address, the post office address. And then, you know, my 7-year-old son, godson, would say, like, "It's near the slushy place." And they'd be like, "Oh, yeah, slushy place." Right. So it's just amazing what works. And that was that probably, we probably added 15 or 20 voters to the vote yesterday, just with the slushy place.
Did you go to the slushy place?
Yes, it was closed yesterday, Sunday. You know, not a good business day, but everybody knows where it is. So I'm probably going to go to it today, because it seems like everyone in town loves the slushy of this particular proprietor. So, yeah, we're going to give that a try. And there's barbecue waiting for us tonight also.
Is there are you noticing? I mean, look, this is totally anecdotal, right? But I would imagine,
right,
even amongst, you say you're in a partially Muslim neighborhood, partially Asian, partially African-American.
Yes.
I would imagine that, particularly in terms of the Muslim voters, but also, I mean, Asians seem
right.
to be breaking. And this is also like a group that traditionally wasn't necessarily overwhelmingly Democratic, but it seems like that's changing a little bit. Are you noting any difference in terms of enthusiasm there?
No, you know, we've talked to a few of them, but most of them just feel like, yeah, sure, they're going to vote, but I don't, you know, there's no sense that there's a great deal of enthusiasm happening from anyone, really. Just that I think, like everybody in America, they kind of want it to be over with.
Right, I would imagine. So not even to vote against somebody, I guess, what I'm asking.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, all right.
No. I think everybody has sort of like the 97% of people a year ago who had a solid, firm opinion one way or the other of Hillary Clinton. You know, I think many of these minds were made up a long time ago. I think the fiction of the undecided voter was something for that debate.
But you're also going to voters who are specifically right, who have been identified as Democratic voters.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
But otherwise, like I said, that would
not
be
a lot
bad.
Of enthusiasm there. But even out on the streets, when I've bumped into Trump voters and talked to them, I don't feel you just don't feel the fervor that you get on television, or in any of those rallies, or the crazy, you know, the Confederate guy with the big mustache. I'm sure he's here, but you just, you know, you don't see him. And I would have expected, for instance, that like many of the Hillary signs would have been torn down, or there would be a lot of, you know, bullet holes and that kind of thing. Well, at least not around here.
And what about the Senate race? Are you getting any indication? Because this is one of the the premier pickup potential races now at this point between Burr and Ross?
From what I can tell, that one is extremely close. There's a lot of arguments that Ross has made too much money. He made a lot of money in office, and that always makes people angry. Politicians aren't supposed to get rich when they're in office, right? I'm just judging from the ads, which, by the way, are wall to wall. Anywhere, if you're near a television and there's not a program on, then you're watching a political ad.
You said Ross, but you mean Burr, that Burr has made too much money.
Burr is, the Burr, Deborah Ross fight. The Governor McCrory versus Cooper is a huge thing.
Mm.
There's also the state Supreme Court here is divided 3-3. And so that election, which is almost untalked about, will completely change grant control of the court to one
wow.
side or the other.
So this could be really huge. The outcome
right.
of this
and so,
North Carolina, I mean, really big, because obviously there's been 3 or 4 years now of Moral Monday protests and
right.
a lot of draconian laws to disenfranchise voters.
Right. And this court would have some, say about voting rights. Or at least that's the way it's been explained to me. So that one, everyone realizes is a pretty big race. But from what I can hear, what I've heard is that, and this is from some of the operatives, is that it's extremely in early counting, it's extremely close with Ross and Cooper.
Wow.
So I think the hope that there would be some sort of giant wave here is not happening. And that this is going to be one of these late-night nail-biters.
Really?
Tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Jack, what do you do? What are your plans for tomorrow? Are you going to be doing more of the Get Out the Vote? Are you?
Absolutely. Yes. And then I think I'm going to go to some kind of vote-counting rally tomorrow night. But if you're on the air, let's do
this.
If you want a
yes.
secondary check-in, I'll gather some more intel before I get on the air tomorrow.
All right. Also,
what's
be prepared.
A good time for you? Well,
I'll text you. Yes. But yeah, also be prepared to give us a review of the slushy.
Done.
All right. Great. Jack Hitt, everybody. Thanks so much. Thanks for the work out there.
All right.
Now, almost 8 years ago to the day, I was in Jack Hitt's house up in New Haven as we were watching the results of the 2008 election. Definitely a different vibe.
Yes.
I mean, we were there. I brought Mila up there. There was like 8 years ago. There was like 10 families up there. Kevin Baker was there. Oh, gosh, a ton of people. Not Kevin Bacon. Kevin Baker, the author.
A beaky bag. Check it. All right, let's take them to the fun half. They got another
Kevin
long
Bacon was
show.
There, and Jennifer Grey, oddly enough, was full of people. No. Kelly's head just like snapped back. Wait, Jennifer Grey was there? Folks, this program can't exist without your support, which is why we make it so easy for you to become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. By becoming a member and spending pennies a day, you ensure that we're able to do programming every single day and an incredibly high caliber of programming, more often than not. I don't want to...
I mean, sometimes...
I don't want to lie. Don't want to put the bar too high. It's all right. Even like when we do that, that becomes
every time before the show,
success.
Sam sits around and he goes, it's going to be a good show, right? Is it this show's going to be a success, right?
We're going to walk through this.
When our numbers grow, we're going to have revenge on all of my other budded enemies.
We're going to read this story in the New York Times about Donald Trump. It's unbelievable.
And then we're going to all reflect on how it influences all of our respective
That's
personalities
right.
and how we've all begun to emulate the man.
It's been... not been healthy at home for the way I've been treating my kids.
I would imagine.
They're all going to stay awake tonight and just hold daddy's hand.
Dad, shouldn't Dad get more blacks on cable news, right? Am I right, kids? But I do a great job, don't I? All right, let's watch the hate
turn
clip
off
again.
Turn off all those other channels and all those other pundits.
Why do you want to watch Arthur cartoons? Dad was on Haze last night. Let's watch it again.
It's Bubble Guppies now.
It's Bubble Guppies now. I don't care. Bubble Guppies are losers.
What's
I'll get revenge
guppies?
Against them, too.
No, Saul, the only thing Saul watches is Paw Patrol.
Oh, yeah, you're right. You told us
oh,
that.
Yes, I am right. Paw yes,
Patrol.
I know. It's Paw Patrol.
Well, I don't know. The kids I know watch Bubble Guppies. Maybe you're depriving him of...
Paw Patrol is a little bit more highbrow. Folks, you can also support this program by, if you buy crap from Amazon or Jet, do it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. You will notice no difference. Go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on one of those links, bookmark it. Always use that as your Jet.com or your Amazon link. Buy your crap through there. We get a kickback. Again, you notice zero difference except for just a little bit. We just sound just a slightly happier. And justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. If you missed any of our ads today, you can go to our website and support our sponsors. Check and see what we're always updating it, or should be. And, we have a little bit of merch left, apparently. Apparently, the link has been dead for like 9 months, and I just got a new one. So we've got to update that soon. Also, give us a review on iTunes. All right, folks, see you in the fun half. 646-257-3920.